Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Deezer, consent decrees and YouTube. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look.
Again, you didn't let me get my there in.
Let's not go through that again.
Last time, that was my fault for putting an extra pause in to trick you. Mm. This time, you didn't even give me the second to say hello there. Well,
you just intone it weirdly. You give me no indication you're going to say anything else.
Well, I always say hello there.
Do you?
Yeah.
It's not in the script.
It may not be in the script, but the script always says something stupid, as I think we've revealed before on set list.
Yeah.
In the notes, you always have me saying something weird in response to you saying hello, which I normally ignore.
Normally, yes.
Yeah.
Except that one time. Well, I think it'd be better if you just read it out as written.
Okay.
As ever, we're going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when, very sadly, and sorry to start on a sad note, but Daniel Johnston died.
Yeah, it's a very sad note to open up from our sort of slightly flippant introduction.
Yeah, well, that was your fault.
And were you going to go solemn from the start?
Yeah.
Was that your plan?
Mm-hmm. If you'd read the script, you'd know. Anyway, we're now torpedoing it further.
It doesn't say in solemn tone.
No, okay, well, just it was inferred.
I don't think he'd want us to be paying tribute in a solemn tone.
No, I'm not sure he would.
I never met him, but my impression is that that's not something he would have liked.
No, well, as we say, well, let's be solemn now and then try to become unsolemn and more celebratory. He has died. It was announced on Wednesday evening, I think, or Thursday last week, that he had died of a heart attack at home, aged 58, which is not old enough, is it?
No, not at all. He had been ill for a number of years, hadn't
yes, he? Yes, he had a number of health problems. He'd just come out of hospital from having a kidney complaint. So we think he was in and out of hospital quite a lot in recent years. And certainly that was one of the reasons he had become less prolific in his musical output.
But a singer-songwriter that, I think it's fair to say, quite a lot of people have never heard of.
It's probably fair to say.
But some people very much in awe of his creativity, what he stood for, and in essence his career and the choices he made along the way.
Yeah, people who have heard of him really like him.
Yes.
So that's why he warrants being mentioned up front here today.
And if you don't know who we're talking about, most of our listeners probably do.
I think so.
I would suspect. But there is that documentary, isn't there?
The Devil and Daniel Johnston.
I think that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yes, it's a good film.
People can go and watch that.
Yeah, they should.
Tells the story.
Yes, and also just listen to his music.
Go on.
Read about him.
To your streaming.
Because if you just come cold to his music, you might be slightly confused.
Yes, get the background first.
But yeah, as we said, a sad passing and far too young.
Indeed. So that's one of the things that have happened. But what else has been happening?
This week, we are going to be discussing all 877 of the submissions to the Department of Justice's new review of the consent decrees that regulate BMI and ASCAP. I didn't take into account how long that sentence was when I wrote it.
A very long sentence, almost as long as all 877 submissions.
Yes. We will also be talking about the US Congress's questions to YouTube about Content ID, well, Google about Content ID. We'll come to that. But first, Deezer went big last week on its hopes to change its royalty payment system to a user-centric one. All it needs to do now is get the majors on board, which is easier said than done. But Deezer is hoping that by enthusing the users themselves, that it can create a tipping point where everyone comes on board and gets behind it. But first of all, Chris, what even is a user-centric payment system?
Yes, that's what Deezer are calling it.
A UCPS.
I will in a moment explain what user-centric royalty processing, as I call it, is all about.
That's not the acronym though, is it?
It isn't. But we weren't here last week because I went out to Paris to Deezer HQ. Never been there before.
Paris? I've been there.
I've been to Paris.
It's quite nearby.
But not Deezer HQ. To have all of this explained to me. I mean, obviously, I knew what user-centric royalty distribution was. We've talked about it at great length in various digital dollar manifestations.
And on this show. But I thought you were mentioning. Yep.
I went over to find out what they are doing and the work that they are doing and then what they subsequently announced. And yes, they have gone with the initials UCPS. They've got lots of graphics with UCPS. I must admit,
sounds like they're launching a delivery company, doesn't it?
At the start of the presentation,
they're pivoting out of streaming.
When they were sort of building up to explaining what they were going to do, I was kind of looking at the pack in front of me, trying to work out what the S stood for.
Ah.
I was like, okay, so UC, yeah, that's user-centric. Understand that. P, I'm assuming, is payment. What's the S? Although I must admit, I then realised that in very big type on the document I was looking at, it did actually have it written out in full. So yes, out in Paris last week to find out more about this. I think the main thing we learned, it was me, some other journalists and a load of Deezer people.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing we learned was that I was right to go a la carte over the lunch. Everyone else went set menu and then was hugely jealous of my roast pork.
Right.
So the main learning of the day was go a la carte. But there was also an explanation of this thing called user-centric.
Well, that sounds like you're now advocating a return to downloads.
Oh, a la carte. Yes, I see. It took me a few seconds to understand what the hell you were talking about there.
Well, you see, you struggled with UCPS, and now you're struggling with my a la carte joke.
I wish I'd just answered your question now, rather than going on this rather needless tangent. What is user-centric royalty distribution?
That is the question I asked some time ago.
A user-centric payment system. Well, I suppose in order to understand what user-centric's all about, you've got to understand how stream royalties are calculated today.
Oh, so you're not going to answer my question?
Not yet. Because I think you need to understand how royalties are calculated by the streaming services when they're paying labels and publishers and artists and songwriters, how the current system works, in order to understand what user-centric is and why Deezer and some others, and since Deezer went big on this last week, quite a few people on the social networks, artists and industry people really backing this, why some people think it's a much fairer way of divvying up the streaming money every month.
Okay, well, you tell me what the current system is, and then I'll ask you the question again.
Good.
We'll get there eventually.
We could have Jason edit it in, couldn't we? Save you having to repeat it. But anyway, let's talk about how Deezer, because Deezer's the streaming service of the moment, in the context...
Never said that before.
In the context of this conversation. How Deezer, but also Spotify and Apple and all the others, how they divvy up the money every month. So streaming is, at its heart, I'm sure I've said this before, a revenue share based on consumption share business, which sounds good.
No, it doesn't.
But tells you nothing. I think it sounds quite impressive.
Okay.
Just kind of meaningless, isn't it? But there's all sorts of complexities in the deals that the record companies and the music publishers and the collecting societies have done with services like Spotify and Deezer. But at the core is a revenue share based on consumption share setup. So let's illustrate this by giving an example. I did some maths. Are you ready for my maths?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say we were to set up a streaming service, the Setlist streaming service.
Right.
And we were to sign up two users, because probably that's as many
that's
as
us. Okay.
That's as many as we'd sign up. So me and you are both subscribers to the Setlist streaming music service that works like any other streaming music service. We're both paying £10 a month,
mm-hmm.
which in the UK means actually we're paying £8 a month, because obviously immediately the government takes £2 or £10 through VAT to, I don't know, fund some incredibly misleading Brexit propaganda, which seems to be what they're mainly doing with tax money at the moment. So you're left with, we've both put £8 into the system. Yes?
Okay, yes.
We've both put £8 into the system. That's £16 in total.
Wow.
And then let's say that you're one of those people who have your streaming service fired up and playing music a lot. You're a high-level user.
You have identified me.
So
yes.
There's you every day starting up your Setlist streaming service when you get up in the morning, I don't know, powering up some shitty J-pop playlist and having it playing back-to-back for 12 hours until it's Netflix time in the
evening. Pretty accurate so far,
So that's 12 hours of play every day. Whereas I am a low-level user. I only use my Setlist streaming service every morning to listen to one album, presumably a Chilly Gonzalez album.
I just thought so.
While I'm getting ready to go out to work. So I listen to one album a day. So probably you're listening to about 180 tracks a day.
Yep.
Over your 12 hours with your J-pop playlist.
Okay.
I'm listening to 10 tracks on whichever Chilly Gonzalez album I've decided to listen to that morning.
Mm-hmm.
So across the month, I'm listening to 300 tracks.
Yep.
You're listening to 5,400 tracks.
Oh, you really have done maths.
Approximately.
Yeah.
These are all approximations. So that's 5,700 tracks. And then the £16 that has come in gets divided up between all the stakeholders. So the service will keep some money, and then the labels and artists will get some money, and the songwriters and publishers will get some money. And it's all divvied up based on consumption share.
Yeah.
So what would happen is all of the money, £16, mm-hmm. would get put into one pot.
Yeah.
And then we'd say, okay, across Chris and Andy, there were 5,700 tracks played.
Yeah.
So we're going to take the £16
mm-hmm.
and we're going to divide it by 5,700.
Yeah.
And then we're going to allocate, now you're ready for this, that would work out at 0.28 of a penny per play.
Good rate, yep.
So we're going to apply 0.28 of a penny per play, and then they're going to share that money with the record labels, distributors, and the publishers and the societies, who in turn will share it with the artists and the songwriters. So each 0.28 of a penny gets split up. So probably 55% maybe will go off to the label or distributor, who will share it with the artist. And 15% will go to the society or the publisher, or both be shared with the songwriter. Mm-hmm. And then we'll keep about 30% of the 0.28 of a penny to run our service.
Yeah.
And so that is what is happening. And so all of those terrible J-pop acts that you listened to...
They're not all terrible.
All right. All those terrible J-pop acts...
A lot of them.
And that good one...
will be terrible.
And Chilly Gonzalez, they're all earning their share of 0.28 pennies per stream under the current system. Okay, revenue share based on consumption share, but crucially, the consumption share is total consumption across all subscribers. So if we were to do this for Deezer or Spotify or Apple, basically all of the millions of subscribers that they have, it's on a country-by-country basis. So they're UK subscribers, they're French subscribers, they're American subscribers, whatever. But the stats are done on a country-by-country basis for all of the users. And we've often said this before, people get obsessed about what is the per-play rate on streaming, but really there isn't a per-play rate. What matters isn't how many times you were streamed, it's of all the streams, what percentage were your music. And at the moment, it's of all the streams across all the users in any one country, what percentage was of your music. That's what's relevant. That's the current, what I would call, service-centric approach.
So the key point is, we both put in £8 each, well, £10, but then £8 once it gets to the service, and then the bulk of both of our money is going to all the music that I listen to.
Correct. So now ask me what user-centric is.
So what is a user-centric system?
So with a user-centric system, we both put our £8 in, but rather than our £8 being put together and all of our plays being put together, the royalty calculations would be done on a user-by-user basis. So they would take your listening data, the 5,400 tracks you've listened to, and your £8, and it would be divvied up. So that would work out at, let me see, 0.14 of a penny now.
Ooh.
And that would be allocated to each track that was streamed and then would be shared with the labels and publishers who represent that track and ultimately the artists and the songwriters. But with my money, because I've only listened to 300 tracks over the month, remember, so my £8 gets divided by 300, which means we now have 2.666666 recurring pennies per stream. We're no longer talking about fractions of pennies. We're now talking about over 2.5 pence per stream available to share out between the label, the publisher, and the service.
Mm.
So clearly, under that system, assuming there's no Chilly Gonzalez on your J-pop playlist, which I'm assuming there wouldn't be.
I don't think he has gone down that road, although I'm surprised.
He's an eclectic artist.
Many have.
I don't think he's ever done any J-pop. So under the current system, with us two, on that scenario, a big chunk of my money is going to the J-pop artist that I have never listened to.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Chilly Gonzalez, who I've exclusively listened to, is only getting a tiny fraction of the money that I put into the system. Whereas under a user-centric system, your J-pop acts will be seeing tiny, tiny, tiny payments per streams. Meanwhile, Chilly Gonzalez will be getting really decent money in the wide scheme of things every single time I listen to one of his tracks.
Mm.
And so that is what user-centric royalty distribution or the user-centric payment system is all about. Now, people have been talking about this for a number of years now.
Yes.
I remember when we were first doing the digital dollar work for the Music Managers Forum, and when I first finally got my head around how it worked, which took quite some time, and I had to sit down with a bunch of people and then go back to those people and say, okay, have I got this right? And yes, you've got that right. And I remember it was at that time a couple of people did say, when we were doing the first round of digital dollar, but who decided this is the best way to do it?
Mm.
And what if we were to take each user's individual subscription and split those up and pay it to the artists and songwriters that individual had listened to? Now, some of the original streaming deals, in addition to all this revenue share based on consumption share nonsense, also had minimum guarantees in them. And there are different ways you can do minimum guarantees. But one way is a per play minimum, where you say, OK, we have this revenue share system, but whatever happens, the record company, say, is guaranteed, I don't know, 0.3 of a penny per stream. And if, for whatever reason, the rev share rate comes below 0.3 of a penny a stream, then the minimum gets paid, rather than what would be due under rev share, at the streaming service's expense, which was the reason why the streaming services, even though the core model is they get to keep about 30% of the money, never did keep 30% of the money. But a per-stream minimum was one of the ways of doing that. And obviously, if you're going to have a per-stream minimum, you can only do that on a service-centric way of distributing the money.
Yes.
Otherwise, on a high user like you, the streaming service would be losing loads and loads of money and not getting the benefit on a low-level user like me because they would be paying on the rev share rate rather than the minimum rate.
Yeah.
So that may have been one of the reasons why it was structured the way it was. Also, arguably, the user-centric approach is slightly more complicated on both sides, the streaming services side and the label distributors side. But, as I say, for a number of years now, there have been people saying, well, hang on a second, why did we agree to do it this way? User-centric seems fairer. And we've known for a while that Deezer in particular have been looking into this and have spoken at a number of conferences about it. But I suppose what's happened in the last week is this is Deezer going much, much more public in saying, we've done some research and we think that this is how it should be done.
Yes, so the key thing they've done in the last week is launch this public-facing website that pushes this idea to consumers more than industry, although obviously industry as well, they're trying to lobby on both sides. But the key thing that it does is that it shows how royalty payments would differ for the artists you listen to under both systems. And particularly if you're a Deezer premium subscriber, you can put in your username and it will show you exactly how much money is going to the artists you listen to versus what they'd be receiving on the user-centric system, under the assumption that most people would want and probably already assume that the artists they listen to are getting the money that they pay into the system.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting little tool that they've put on this website. So yeah, if you are a Deezer premium subscriber, you go in, as you say, put your login, and it will say, okay, of the subscription money you put in last month, so in France, that would be €10, wouldn't it? In the UK, it'd be £10, X percent. And I know some Deezer premium users who have done that, and it's come up with like 9% of the money.
Yeah.
9% of the money you put in actually went to artists that you listened to, which means that 91% of the money was going off to artists that high-level users were listening to that you've potentially never listened to, and they're getting a chunk of your money. And yeah, you're right. I suspect that obviously most users of streaming services have never even really considered how the money gets shared out and certainly don't know how the money gets shared out. And I think probably a lot of those people would have assumed that their money was being shared out between the artists and songwriters whose music they listen to, and therefore will be quite shocked if they are one of those subscribers who goes in and finds out that 90% of their money is going to artists that they don't rate.
Yes. So initially, Deezer is aiming to change the system next year in France on the royalties it pays record labels and distributors. And the reason it's doing it in France is because Deezer is a French service and France is the one place where it's one of the bigger services and has the power to affect change in that way, or potentially affect change because they haven't done it yet. They still have to get the majors on board, although some smaller labels are apparently very much behind the change in the system.
Yeah, no, the official press materials to accompany the launch of the site last week did list a bunch of French labels and independent distributors who have formally said, yeah, we support this move to shift to a user-centric royalty distribution system in 2020 in France on the recording side. So do it step by step.
Yeah.
As you say, although Deezer's a global service, France is its home country and it is the market where Deezer actually is a significant player. Whereas in places like the UK, it's a relatively small player. It still needs everybody to come on side, but I suppose providing they can talk the majors over, then they have sufficient market share in France that they can put pressure on everybody else to say, we're going to do this experiment. And, I mean, they would never say it like this. They certainly didn't say it like this last week. But, you know, you will get to the point of saying, well, either you're in or you're out, and Deezer is a significant enough player in the French market that you can't afford to be out.
Yeah.
Having said that, it needs to bring the majors with it. And it was interesting, they had this list of independents who were supporting it. There were various management groups and artist groups who were also supporting it. When it comes to the majors, word has it that Warner is supportive, although, of course, Deezer and Warner have shareholders in common.
Yeah, so that helps.
Access Industries owns Warner and is a significant shareholder in Deezer. It's interesting that the word is that when it comes to Sony and Universal, I mean, They haven't put out any official statements on this, and Deezer had no official statements on this. But what we hear is that actually Sony and Universal don't have a united view on this, and that within Sony and Universal, there is differences of opinion, which is potentially partly because of who the winners and losers would be of shifting to a user-centric system, and whether or not your bit of the major record company has mainly winners or mainly losers.
Yes. So generally, like across the whole catalogue of a major label, which has such a vast catalogue, probably you'll have enough winners and losers that it's not going to make much of a difference. Some people will win, some people lose. It will balance out over the whole catalogue. But then, obviously, the major label isn't one thing. It's lots of smaller labels as part of a group. And therefore, you might have some significant labels in your group that are going to be large losers over their catalogue because they have whatever type of artist. So non-Anglo-American repertoire likely to be a winner. Niche genres are likely to see a boost versus mainstream genres. And then artists with older fan bases as well likely to see a boost from the change of the system. If you've got a significant label in your group that's going to be a loser in that, you're possibly going to be less keen to make the switch.
Yeah, and I suppose within the major record companies, although, as you say, chances are the group at large, its bottom line isn't going to be affected because it will both win and lose in equal measures. But there may be individual executives within the record company who are bonused, not on the performance of the entire company, but on their division. And so if they're in a division with artists who are potentially going to be losers, then they might not be so keen. Also, in addition to what you've just said in terms of winners and losers, I mean, various people have crunched the figures on this with slightly different results.
Yeah.
And actually, interestingly, I mean, one thing that does come out from quite a lot of the research in saying, okay, if we were to take last year's figures from Spotify or Deezer or whoever, but we were to have calculated it from a user-centric system rather than service-centric, one thing that has come out from those studies is that the differences are not quite as striking as you might think. But as you say, yes, non-Anglo-American repertoire, niche genres, artists of older fan bases probably will be the winners. The flip side being that the big Anglo-American superstar artists, particularly in sort of the urban pop genres, are likely to be the biggest losers. And obviously for Sony and Universal, that would include some of their biggest global stars.
Yeah.
And so if they go gung-ho on user-centric, it might require them to say to some of the biggest stars, which are hugely important to the business, we're going to support a system, which means you will be making slightly less. Now, the chances are that those global superstars in public would not be able to speak out against the system, which will see some of the money redistributed from their very full bank accounts down to the bank accounts of more niche artists or more grassroots artists who could really do with the money. So I think publicly, it's going to be really hard for any of the superstar artists and their backers in the corporate side to speak out against this. But behind the scenes, they may be less supportive of a system which is going to hit their bottom line. It will have more of an impact on artists than on labels, as you've said. And the general consensus is, the superstars will see their royalties go down slightly in percentage terms. Meanwhile, the grassroots artists will see their income go up. It is interesting that one point Deezer made, they were basically saying, if we're going to do this, and Deezer's official line is, it's a better, fairer way of doing it, doesn't really make much difference to the streaming services, ultimately.
Yeah.
But they think it's a better way of doing it. And what they're saying is, if we're going to do this at all, we should do it now. Because obviously, one of the downsides of shifting over to user-centric is the entire industry has built itself to calculate and manage and audit and monitor royalties on a service-centric system. So the services have set their systems up that way. The labels, the distributors, the collecting societies, everybody has set everything up to deal with the current system. And clearly, switching over to a new system is going to require some changes. Now, there is divided opinion on quite how big a logistical challenge that will be.
Yeah.
Some saying massive, some saying actually not as big as everyone is saying. But what Deezer was saying was the logistical challenge is only going to get harder as the streaming market continues to grow. So if we're going to do it, we might as well do it now, rather than leaving it another few years and having 250 million more subscribers across the market to deal with. And then the other thing they mentioned in terms of the superstar artists seeing their income go down slightly as a result of the shift, they were saying, but because streaming continues to boom, because the superstar artists are the biggest beneficiaries of that, the labels are probably the biggest beneficiaries of that, but In terms of the artist community, the superstars are the biggest beneficiaries. How much they're earning from streaming keeps going up every month anyway. So it's not actually that the figures would go down, it's just that the growth rate would slow. They would still be making more in 2020 than they did in 2019, just not quite as much more as they would have made if they'd stick to service-centric. So again, they were saying now is the time to do it because it's only going to get harder logistically as more and more people sign up. Actually, the superstars who will see their money go down in percentage terms almost won't notice the change because they will still be making more, just not quite as much more. And if, like Deezer, you think it is a fair way of doing it, then we should make this switch ASAP. Interesting that they're going on the recording side first. It is their ambition to apply this to songwriters and publishers too, but everything to do with songwriting and publishing is always more complicated. So try it on recordings first. But it will be fascinating to see, with this extra push and the response to it, will they persuade Sony and Universal to come on board next year? It is an all or nothing. They can't pay some labels one way and other labels the other. Will they get the majors on board? And then if they do, obviously, does it work? Does it have the impact everyone is hoping? And will they look then to roll it out across all rights in all territories? And what about Spotify and Apple? Will they come under pressure to switch as well?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose for Deezer, although clearly it would say this is a fairer system for everyone and so would want it to apply across all services, I think realistically, part of the reason for doing it is to differentiate themselves as a service. And it's quite a good PR move.
It
say,
is, isn't it?
We've come up with a fairer system and we want to implement it and we want to be the drivers of that change.
Because you know how Tidal went with the we're the artist-friendly streaming service because look at all these superstars on our board, but nobody really knew what that meant and really it's just the same. And then some people in America will say, oh, Apple pays more than Spotify, it's more friendly. But I mean, really, that's because Apple doesn't have a free version. And when you average the figures out, if you have a free version, it looks like you're paying less. But I would say of all of the services trying to say we're the artist-friendly, there are issues of user-centric and there are people who say be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
So I'm putting a massive footnote there to say not necessarily 100% thinking this is definitely the right way forward. But there are all sorts of reasons to say for grassroots artists, for mid-level artists, for niche artists, for domestic talent, this does feel like a fairer system. And to be the service that spearheaded that, a service which outside of France is very much third and usually fourth on the list, yeah, it's a great way of distinguishing themselves.
Yeah, well, if they pull it off and it goes well, and suddenly you've got lots of maybe more niche but kind of well-liked artists saying Deezer pays much better than other streaming services, you should use that initially, you know, in France. But that could be a way for Deezer to grow market share where, I mean, the services ultimately, there's not that big a difference between any of them. So really putting yourself out, really having artists behind you saying, well, I'll get more money from Deezer, that would be quite a good PR move for them. Not that I'm saying this is a cynical thing, but you could frame it that way.
And you just did. But anyway, yeah, definitely one to watch in 2020.
Yes, so that website, if you want to go and have a look at it, is deezer.com/UCPS. Still to come, why isn't Google making YouTube's content ID system available to more artists and labels? But now, the US Department of Justice has published, as we said earlier, 877 submissions to its review of the consent decrees that regulate American collecting societies, BMI and ASCAP, which has highlighted, as you might guess, the differing opinions on both sides of the debate.
So yes, this is the latest review of the way that the two big song right performing rights organisation collecting society things,
it's really hard not to make that a long sentence,
are regulated in the United States of America.
We had one a few years ago. I remember it. I think we probably discussed it on this show.
Yes, it is only a few years since the last review of the way collective licensing in America is regulated. So collective licensing, where loads of songwriters and publishers get together and license all of their works collectively, always raises competition law concerns. And so in most countries, there is some sort of regulation of the collective licensing system to try and overcome those competition concerns. The most draconian regulations are in the US, where BMI and ASCAP are regulated by these things called consent decrees, which are basically agreements that the two societies reached with the US Department of Justice decades ago, which continue to regulate how they operate. The music industry has long argued that these are old documents, they're out of date, they're not fit for purpose, we need to tear them up and start again. Ultimately, we should just get rid of them, is the position of BMI and ASCAP. But in the short term, we should rewrite them, make them much simpler. That's what the music industry has been lobbying for some time now. Although that review you mentioned a few years ago, the conclusion of that review was, let's keep everything the way it is.
Yeah. So it's all fine.
It's all fine. So obviously, BMI, ASCAP, their members, the songwriters, the publishers, are desperately hoping that this time round, the DOJ, the Justice Department, reaches a very different conclusion. Anyone interested, so that's mainly creators and owners of songs and users of songs, were invited to submit their opinions. The deadline, I think, got extended and was in the middle of August. And last week, the Justice Department put links to all of them on its website.
Yes, so 877 submissions does seem like quite a lot.
And it is.
And it is.
That's a lot of PDFs.
Although once you delve into them, it's not quite so daunting. More than 760 of them, that's about 90%, are calling for the consent decrees to remain as they are. So that looks like it's a clear-cut case.
On simple maths, it looks like many more people want the consent decrees to remain, contrary to what the music industry is asking for. There's an organisation called the MIC Coalition, which would like you to know that we should be saying the Mike Coalition. Yeah. It says so on its homepage. The first thing it says before it even explains what it is or what it stands for is how to pronounce its name.
So that's the MIC Coalition.
The MIC, pronounced as Mike Like Microphone Coalition, as it says on its homepage. The MIC Coalition, the Mike Coalition, put out a statement saying, look, the vast majority of these submissions, of which there were many, are saying we should keep the consent decrees as they are. It represents various sectors that use music, so venues, bars, restaurants, radio stations, and tech companies. Its position is the consent decrees should remain. And so it was saying, just look at the maths, all of these submissions saying keep the decrees in place. But as you say, if you actually open some of those 877, in fact, all you have to do, they're in alphabetical order, all you have to do is open the first 10 on the Justice Department website, and you'll quickly notice a lot of them are the same submission.
Yes.
Because some sectors encouraged individual businesses, users of music, to make a submission. And clearly, one of the organisations provided a template. And I'm assuming there must have been a website that even set the email up. It wasn't that you cut and pasted some pre-prepared copy into an email. I think there must have been a website that was allowing mainly owners of bars and pubs and wine bars and things like that, I think, must have been using a website to create these emails. The reason I say that is there is one sentence in the middle of the submission, and this submission has been made many, many, many times. A lot of the 877 submissions are this same submission. And in the middle of one sentence, it's clearly meant to say the name of the company that has submitted the submission. But instead, it has the job title of the person whose name is at the top of the letter. So I'm assuming something went wrong in the automated system.
So it's complaining that rather than removing the consent decrees, making it more difficult to play music in whatever bar, it's just going to make it more difficult for the person who sent the submission personally to play music.
Yeah, you end up with quite a clunky sentence. So I'm assuming there must have been some sort of website that automated all of this. So yes, a lot of them are template submissions put in by individual bars. Obviously, each of those bars has every right to make a submission, and you know, providing they agree with whoever wrote the original template, then it's fine for them to submit it. But it's important to note that when it comes to the music industry side of this debate, the community who think that there should be radical change of the decrees, just like BMI and ASCAP themselves, the songwriters predominantly signed up to one of two submissions. So basically, there is a submission for BMI members and there is a submission for ASCAP members, both of which are signed by thousands of songwriters.
Yes. So if you go by number of signatories, then the music industry side has vastly more.
Yeah, if BMI and ASCAP, rather than getting everybody to sign one submission, had set up a website where every songwriter could send in a separate submission, it would have been 20,000 submissions. So the top line figures are misleading. If you actually then read the submissions, rather than just counting them, most of them are presenting either side of the argument, depending on which side of the fence they are on, And we already knew the arguments because BMI and ASCAP had already set out their agenda as soon as we knew this review was coming up. They want a much simplified consent decree, which has what we call a sunset clause, which means that at some point the Department of Justice could stop regulating the societies entirely. We knew that's what BMI and ASCAP wanted. We knew the vast majority of trade organizations for songwriters and publishers agree with that. And then we knew that the Mike Coalition and all the other trade bodies and businesses that it represents, they like the consent decrees, they like the limitations it puts on BMI and ASCAP. Their assumption is, well, their official line is, any change, any radical change will cause chaos in the way that music is licensed in the US, and who wants chaos? I mean, the real concern is that an empowered BMI and ASCAP would demand more money, and so the rates would go up.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, that's what the other side are frightened of, and so they're saying the current system should be contained. So in the submissions, all 877, I must admit, I didn't read all 877.
But most of them are the same.
But most of them are that same template. But most of the submissions are presenting the arguments we already knew, whether it's the we need to radically reform these arguments on the music industry side or the we need to keep everything the same on the broadcaster, bar, restaurant side. But there were some interesting submissions presenting alternative viewpoints. And I would say an interesting one from our perspective was the one made by Global Music Rights, a rival collecting society to BMI and ASCAP, which is an organisation that represents about 80 very famous songwriters. So it is a music community organisation. This is a music industry submission, but it wants the consent decrees to stay in place. So from our point of view, that's probably the most interesting submission because it is a music industry submission, which, unlike all of the other music industry submissions, is saying, yeah, actually, we would like the consent decrees to remain.
Yes, because while GMR is not a fan of the idea that collecting societies by default should be artificially constrained when negotiating licenses with users of music, I mean, that's why GMR exists.
Yes, to
because
allow.
It felt that BMI and ASCAP weren't getting enough money for those top-level songwriters that it represents now.
And pretty much ever since GMR was established in 2013, set up by the veteran artist manager Irving Azoff, and so its initial members were songwriters that he represents as manager, but then a whole bunch of other, I'd say mainly very significant famous songwriters have signed up. And pretty much ever since it's launched, one thing that GMR has been desperately trying to do is fight the American radio industry, which has been trying to force GMR not to accept a consent decree level regulation, but to agree to some sort of mediation system when GMR and the radio stations can't agree on rates. There is another smaller collecting society in the US that's been going quite a long time called CSAC. It isn't covered by a consent decree because it's a lot smaller than BMI and ASCAP, but it does have agreements in place with both the radio industry and the TV industry so that there is a mediator who can intervene when the two sides can't agree on royalties. And the radio industry have been trying to force through the courts GMR to accept the same thing. GMR have been fighting that, and actually in this document they lay in to the American radio industry over this. So no fan of constraints that force, by default, collecting societies to agree to allow somebody else to intervene when it comes to rate setting. Under the consent decree, BMI and ASCAP, there are rate courts, specific courts designed to mediate and intervene on royalty rates. So yeah, GMR not wanting collecting societies by default to be regulated, but points out that there are other aspects to the BMI and ASCAP consent decrees that it does support.
Yes, because as well as stepping in to intervene on rates, the consent decrees also are there to encourage more competition in terms of recruiting members in the song licensing domain. So there's more choice for songwriters and therefore more of a commercial incentive for societies to provide better services to their songwriter and publisher members.
Yeah, so what basically GMR is saying is whenever people talk about the consent decrees, they talk about the competition law concerns of societies, big societies like BMI and ASCAP, exploiting their massive catalogues of music to hold the customers, the licensees, to ransom. And so the consent decree has various measures to try and stop that. But what GMR is saying, we need to remember there's a whole other side to the consent decrees, which is to stop BMI and ASCAP from abusing their market dominance within the songwriter community. And that what the Justice Department has always said is that it wants competition in the collective licensing domain. So as a songwriter, you have a choice of collecting societies that you can go and join and allow to license your performing rights to radio stations and venues and bars, etc. And different societies can offer different levels of service, different levels of transparency. They can have different ways of reporting and calculating how the money gets shared out. And then as a songwriter, you can pick which of those you like best and then easily and quickly transfer your rights. So I've gone off this society, so I'm going to this society and I want to be able to move my rights really quickly. And obviously, America is quite unusual. In most European countries, there is a single collecting society.
Yeah.
Representing the performing rights of songwriters. And in some countries, copyright law has kind of allowed or even created that monopoly. But there are plenty of countries where, under copyright law, there could be multiple collecting societies. There just isn't, because no one's ever set them up. Whereas in the US, and some other countries, but the US in particular, there are the four collecting societies, BMI and ASCAP, the big guys, CSAC, smaller, GMR, very new, and actually just in the last couple of years, two new societies have entered the market, aiming more at the grassroots talent, whereas CSAC and GMR tend to go for the big name talent, and then BMI and ASCAP is everybody else. But what GMR is saying is that without the consent decrees, BMI and ASCAP might use their market dominance not to get more money out of the licensees, but to make it harder for songwriters to move their rights around the system. And GMR is saying, the Justice Department has always said, the reason we have these consent decrees is we want a more competitive collective licensing system, a more competitive song licensing market. We at GMR, we're doing that, but we need BMI and ASCAP to be kept in line to allow that to happen. Which is why GMR, even though it's in the music industry, and even though most music industry organisations are saying, yes, we want radical reform to the consent decrees with a sunset clause that ultimately means the consent decrees go entirely, GMR is saying, no, we do still want regulation of BMI and ASCAP to allow other alternative options to prosper in the market so that songwriters have more choice on where they put their rights. So I thought out of all of the 877 submissions, that was the interesting one because it wasn't predictable.
Yeah.
All the others, that organization clearly represents songwriters or music publishers. They're going to ask for radical reform. That organization clearly represents bars or a wine company or a venue or a radio station. They're clearly going to want to keep the consent decrees in place. Everybody else was really predictable. And that was an interesting alternative perspective.
Throws a bit of a spanner in the works when the DOJ are going through all this paperwork.
So if you fancy reading all 877 submissions, including however many of them are that single template.
It won't take you as long as you might think.
Although, I mean, some of them are quite long. The template ones are all quite short. But I mean, like ASCAP and BMI submissions are really quite long. But they are all on the Justice Department website. We'll put a link to the page where you can download them. Because I'm sure you will all be rushing to do that.
Yeah, setlistpodcast.com if you want to go and find that link. And finally this week, eight members of Congress in the US have sent a letter to Google requesting that the US web giant, or American web giant?
American web giant. We discussed the other week when we were discussing Chinese web giants. There are non-Chinese web giants, and I think it's fair to say Google's one of them.
Anyway, Congress, these eight members of Congress, rather, want Google to come and join in with a roundtable discussion about YouTube's content ID technology. And while they ask various questions about it in their letter, a key concern seems to be why the rights management software is not available to a wider range of copyright owners.
Yeah, so Content ID, of course, is YouTube's rights management system, which allows record companies and music publishers to put their music into the system so that when any other YouTube user uploads a video containing somebody else's music, if that music is in the Content ID system, in theory, the platform should automatically spot, hey, hang on a second, this video of somebody on a skateboard or a cat or whatever else it is.
Or a cat on a skateboard.
Or a cat on a skateboard.
Or a skateboard on a cat.
The music in this video is actually that recording which is owned by Universal, or it's that song which is represented by this publisher or this society. And then through the Content ID system, once the automated technology has spotted a recording or spotted the song, it works for other content as well, not just music, but we're interested in it from a music perspective. Once it's done that, whoever owns the copyright in that recording or song can do one of two things. They can either block the video, say, I don't want that video of a cat with my track in the background, or they can say, I'm happy for that video to be up there, but I want the advertising money. So any advertising money created around that video will now come to me as the copyright owner, not of the video, but of the music. So that's what Content ID does. Obviously, because YouTube claims safe harbor protection. Boy, do we know that YouTube claims safe harbor protection. It is obliged under copyright law, in order to have this safe harbor protection that may or may not prevent it from being held liable for the copyright infringement in all the videos that are uploaded every day onto that platform. In order to enjoy safe harbor protection, it has to offer some sort of system by which a copyright owner can say, that's my music in that video. That video maker did not have my permission. Remove that video. So YouTube is obliged to offer some sort of system that does that. But, you know, to be fair, Content ID goes much further than that.
Yeah.
And allows copyright owners not only to block videos that includes their music or whatever without permission, but actually, better than that, don't block the video, monetize it and make some money instead. So that's what Content ID does. These eight lawmakers in Congress in Washington want Google, YouTube to come in. And some of their questions are, well, I probably answered some of their questions. They also want to know about the technology behind it and how it works. I can't help thinking, I mean, I can't remember which eight Congress people were writing this letter. I suspect they probably wouldn't understand the answer to any questions actually about how audio recognition technology works.
No, well, I mean, you could say that was unfair given that you can't remember their names. But when Mark Zuckerberg went in to answer questions about Facebook, when they, people questioning him then didn't seem to know even the basics of how Facebook works, so... yeah, I think it's probably fair to say they're not going to be on top of this.
But
however, they did have some questions that suggested they do have a bit better idea about it.
Or at least some people who do understand what's going on have been griping to them.
Yeah.
Because as you said at the start of this section, probably the most interesting question that they're asking is about who has access to Content ID. Because if you are a content maker, so that might be a record company or music publisher or an artist, or it could be making any sort of video content going up on YouTube. There are various ways you can have a relationship with YouTube. I mean, anyone can have a YouTube channel. We could have a setlist YouTube channel.
I was going to say we do, but we don't.
No. Famously, it's the one platform which, for some reason that we've never been quite able to identify, we don't have a presence on YouTube, even though we're on pretty much every other platform where content can be posted. But anyone can have a YouTube channel, and you can put videos up there, providing you're willing to sign up to all the terms and conditions, which you don't read. The next level up is to become a proper content partner of YouTube. You need to have a certain number of subscribers and a certain number of views per month or per year. I think it's per month to qualify for that. And that's when you can start to monetize the content. You can start to put advertising around your content and make money. But access to Content ID, to this super high-tech rights management system, is much more restricted. And that's one of the key questions these Congress people are asking. Why is it restricted to certain copyright owners rather than all copyright owners? What are the criteria? Why aren't you making it available to more people?
Yeah, because smaller artists and labels can get access to it, but they probably need to do it through their distributor rather than direct through YouTube.
Yeah, so if you are an artist signing up to YouTube with a channel or indeed an independent label, yeah, you're not going to get Content ID as part of your YouTube account. So it has generally been the norm in the music industry that unless you are a bigger record company or a bigger music distributor, in order to access this particular element of the YouTube platform, as I said, anyone can set up a YouTube channel, any artist with a bit of traction, if you get the user figures, you can start monetizing your content. But often, yeah, you still need a distributor, even if you're not using the distributor to distribute to YouTube, because you're putting your content directly onto YouTube, you probably still want a distributor of decent size, because they will have access to Content ID. And that's how you then get access to Content ID as a DIY artist or a smaller label.
So the Congress member's letter says on this subject, it has come to our attention that access to the Content ID system is only granted to companies that, quote, own exclusive rights to a substantial body of original material that is frequently uploaded to the YouTube user community, end quote. We are concerned, continue quote, quote within quote, we are concerned that copyright holders with smaller catalogues of works cannot utilise Content ID, making it more difficult or impossible for them to effectively protect their copyright works from infringement and ultimately impacting on their livelihoods. End of quote. Main quote. Not the quote within the quote.
Not the quote within the quote.
I never opened the initial quote properly.
No. Maybe we
there
should.
Are no more quotes.
We'll say quote and we'll get Jason to edit it in. No, it's fine.
People understand. I've just made it complicated.
People are completely on board with what you're saying. Talking of being on board with what you're saying, what interested me was once we'd reported on this, and a couple of other tech sites reported on it as well, and there's a copy of the letter doing the rounds, I was interested in the reaction amongst particularly the indie label community, in that a number of indie labels and organisations representing indie labels welcomed this intervention by these eight Congress members. I also saw some songwriters, obviously on the songwriting side, often for songwriters and even publishers, there might be a collecting society or a copyright hub between you and a service like YouTube. So I got the sense from the indie label community, from the songwriter publisher community, that there are plenty of not DIY artists at all, not bedroom artists, smaller rights owners, labels, publishers, for whom this has been a bit of a gripe in recent years. But it's not really, given how much we've been bloody talking about YouTube and its relationship with the music industry, it's not something that has come up anywhere near as much. So it will be interesting to see, first of all, how Google and YouTube respond to this letter, and if they do agree to do some sort of roundtable, how they respond to that question. And also whether this is going to kickstart a wider debate about who does have access to this rights management platform, to Content ID, and should it be rolled out to a wider range of labels and publishers, etc.
Of course, YouTube might say, if they respond to this question, is that Content ID is a very powerful tool, and so that's why they have to be careful about who they give it to, because if you start giving it to every random DIY artist, all those artists might then start just blocking videos all over the place, possibly without the right to. And so that's why you kind of need to restrict it and know who you're giving the tool to.
Yeah, well, although Content ID obviously has some tools built into it to try and stop people from abusing the system. And of course, anybody who has their video blocked or their royalties claimed by another party can dispute that. And there's a process to deal with those disputes. So they have tried to build contingencies in the system to deal with people and ultimately to punish people who abuse the system. But yeah, I suspect, I mean, I'm not aware of them ever talking about this on the record in the past, but I'm pretty sure that is what they would say, which is Content ID does give a copyright owner quite a lot of power within the YouTube system. So you need to be certain that A, you trust them, and then B, just that they have the technical savvy to use it properly and not maliciously block videos, but just screw things up and block a load of videos in the process. So I suspect that is probably what they will say. But I sense from the independent label community and from the independent publishers that there may well be plenty of copyright owners who are saying, yeah, we get that, but we think you've definitely set the bar too high for getting access to this. And there are plenty of very responsible people who completely would know how to use this system appropriately and correctly, who you're currently blocking from having direct access to it, so that we have to use a middleman, a distributor, in order to enjoy the tools you have created to help us manage our copyrights on your platform.
So, as you say, we'll have to wait and see what happens with that, and perhaps we'll come back to that on a future edition of Setlist. But for now, we've run out of time.
That's it.
That is all we've got time for this week on Setlist. If you have any questions or comments about anything we've discussed in this episode, or indeed any episode, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk.
I have a suspicion that the next edition of Setlist is going to be a special.
Is that because it is?
I'm saying that because this time next week I'm going to be in Hamburg for the Reeperbahn Festival, and therefore I assume not in Shoreditch recording a podcast.
You would think not.
So a special edition coming up, another in our series of the top 10 legal battles of all time in the music industry. Not all legal battles. That would be a very wide topic, wouldn't it? So that's happening next week, and then I think we're probably back for a proper review of the week edition the week after that.
You might be right. Well, we might have in 2 weeks of specials.
Oh, actually, I think you might be right.
I could look it up in the calendar.
No, you're right, because in 2 weeks today, I'll be in Birmingham.
Oh,
Hamburg
similar
and
to
Birmingham.
Hamburg.
I'm seeing all the big cities over the next couple of weeks, and Dublin somewhere along the way. So yeah, there might be two special editions in a row. And then, so basically, music industry, if nothing could happen in the next fortnight, that would be really good for us.
Yeah.
And then have a really eventful week for when we come back.
Yes. So we'll be speaking to you, I mean, not live, but, you know, more live. We'll have a standard edition in a couple of weeks' time. But in between, you'll be getting some specials looking at one topic each. And oh, there's some good ones because I know what they're about. And anyway, but that is all we've got time for this week. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.